From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, U.S. arms to Syria, surveillance uproar, genes in the high court, and Colorado burning. The U.S. says chemical weapons have been used in Syria, and Washington will give military support to the rebel command, the Supreme Military Council. Here's Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes.
The president has made a decision about providing more support to the opposition. That will involve providing direct support to the SMC. That includes military support.
29-year-old leaker Edward Snowden says Americans need to know about NSA surveillance. Critics in both parties hit back hard. Here's Republican Congressman Peter King.
I think he's either a defector or a traitor. You know, I guess take your pick. I think what he's done has been incredible damage to our country. It's going to put American lives at risk.
And wildfire in Colorado claims hundreds of homes in the most destructive fire in that state's history. One resident who lost his home could barely come to grips with the destruction.
You work your whole life to have your own little place on this globe. You find some place that's special to you, and then it's gone.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Mark Mazzetti of the New York Times, Susan Davis of USA Today, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How do you see Syria now? U.S. surveillance, Edward Snowden. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Mark Mazzetti, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, national security correspondent for the New York Times. His latest book is The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and a War at the Ends of the Earth. Mark Mazzetti, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
It's good to have you today. And with us from Washington, Susan Davis, chief congressional correspondent for USA Today. Susan Davis, welcome back to you as well. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty's here. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Mark, and Susan.
We have got a groaning board of stories to look at here, and they just keep coming as this week comes to its close. Mark Mazzetti, what exactly is the White House saying? What are they saying they're going to do with the Syrian opposition that we weren't going to do, I don't know, yesterday?
Well, there's things they're saying privately, and there's things they're saying publicly. Privately, they are acknowledging that they are going to be doing direct arms shipments to select groups of Syrian rebels. It'll be coordinated by the Central Intelligence Agency. What is different is that the U.S., the Obama administration, up to this point has only said they would provide humanitarian relief, humanitarian support, and medical aid for the rebels. Now they're talking about direct lethal aid. It comes at a sort of the end of a really amazing week on Syria, where not only do you have yesterday's announcement of chemical weapons use by the Assad regime, but even before that, you had this flurry of meetings in Washington because there's this great concern that in the last 2 weeks, basically, the rebellion is collapsing. And government forces are taking back town by town. And if something is not done, this could be over quickly. And so the question is now, is what the Obama administration is providing, is it too little too late?
An odd time, maybe, to come in with weapons when maybe it's closing down. That word on chemical weapons, which President Obama called a red line earlier, came back this week. Here's Ben Rhodes, Deputy National Security Advisor, saying the U.S. has concluded that Assad's forces have crossed the red line.
Our intelligence community assesses that the Assad regime has used chemical weapons, including the nerve agent sarin, on a small scale against the opposition multiple times in the last year.
Many who still don't want to get involved in Syria at all, but on the other hand, many who say, if we're going to, this may be too little too late. Here's Republican South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham on the Senate floor yesterday.
My big fear is that weapons of mass destruction are going to fall into the hands of radical Islamists, either in Iran or Syria, if we don't act quickly.
And here's John McCain.
They need a lot more than military assistance. We need to establish the no-fly zone. We need a safe zone within Syria. Every time that we have escalated a bit in our assistance, the Russians, Hezbollah, the Iranians are all in. And so you've got to change the equation on the ground, and you can't do it with half measures. You cannot do it with just supplying weapons.
Susan Davis, does the White House have support on Capitol Hill for getting involved at this point with weapons when they've held off to this point? And now, as Mark says, the tide seems to be maybe turning very sharply against the rebels.
I do think that the president has a certain pockets of key support. And the two senators, obviously, that we just heard from, Senators McCain and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, have been two of the most vocal and prominent voices who have been urging the president for some time to take greater action in Syria. McCain has also advocated for allowing the use of the U.S. military to do airstrikes, targeted airstrikes in Syria as well. I think it's two things. I think there, for many, even among liberals on Capitol Hill, I think that there is the humanitarian interest in trying to do something in Syria. The use of chemical weapons, obviously, is an offensive act for members across the political spectrum. But I don't think you can underestimate how the war weariness, and Lindsey Graham did talk about this yesterday, where he said, I hope the war weariness on Capitol Hill isn't enough to make us not act. Separately, the House right now is actually debating the annual defense bill, where they authorize the authorization bill. And they approved largely a symbolic amendment yesterday to actually accelerate the withdrawal of forces in Afghanistan, which was symbolic in the sense that it does, over more than 300 lawmakers voted for it. And it does underscore that there is a deep reluctance to further engage the U.S. military on Capitol Hill. The good news for the president in the sense that if he does act, he won't necessarily require an act of Congress to do the kind of things that John McCain and others are advocating for to engage in Syria.
Mark, can you explain to us we have seen these severe rebel losses recently, Qusair and now Aleppo under attack as we speak by government forces. Help us understand the logic here of now at this point coming in. Is there some game plan here that's not evident to the naked eye? What's the point of getting involved late with weapons if it's going the other way? Does the White House see a way to turn it around? What would that require?
It's no secret whatsoever that the White House has been trying to avoid this and very, very reluctant to get more deeply involved. Last summer, the president declared that if chemical weapons were used, it would be a, quote, red line. I think some in the White House and some of the administration thought they never should have made that statement, because once you say something is a red line, if that red line gets crossed, well, then therefore you have to act. And if you don't, you look feckless. Right. So.
But even before they said that, Mark, they said Secretary of State Clinton at the time, President Obama, more or less, they said Assad will fall. It's only a matter of time. Well, really?
Right. And it certainly doesn't seem that way with you have, as you said, the government on the offensive retaking key towns. You also have a real fracturing of the rebellion, where you have what are the, quote, moderate groups that the United States would like to support, and which countries like Saudi Arabia and Jordan and the UAE have wanted to support. And then you have more radical Islamist groups that Qatar and other countries have tried to support. The U.S. is almost equally as concerned about the Islamists as they are about Assad. So this is really one reason why you've seen this tremendous reluctance by the White House to get involved. They have relied on their allies to be involved. But again, with this, quote, red line being crossed, I think the White House felt like it had to make some public statement, take some public act.
Jack Beatty, do you see a strategy here? This is very late in the game to get engaged, but here's the statement. We will pull out the weapons for the rebels. As Mark says, they may be going down.
They may be. I don't think yet, though, that this action is disjunct from the diplomatic arena. You know, the rebels were saying, we won't even talk. We won't even go to Geneva or wherever it's going to be next month, if it ever happens. We're not going to go to this putative conference unless we're armed, because we have no leverage. So, you know, this is a kind of minimus step, it seems to me, to give them, to restore their, quote, morale, at least to the degree that if there is a conference, they could come. But it also happens, I mean, at a moment when the, Susan talked about the humanitarian crisis, a new report from the UN, 93,000 killed. Translate that into American terms, that's 1 million Americans. And this report from the UN talks about children being used not just as snipers, but also as human shields. I mean, it's a grotesque, but as you look deeper into it, although the preponderance of this fearsome violence is being perpetrated by the Assad regime, you also have reports in the New York Times last week of a massacre in a Shiite village of Shiites in eastern Syria by the rebels. And there was another report of what Aleppo was like under rebel control. It was a jihadi group, and there was a young 14-year-old boy was executed merely for saying the name Muhammad in a disrespectful way. The point is, these desperate people in Syria are caught between these jihadis and this really murderous regime.
Mark Mazzetti, just a half minute before the break, is the Obama administration prepared to see Assad prevail, the rebels lose?
Well, I mean, publicly, they'll say that, their position is the same, that they want Assad to go down, and they are willing to help the rebels. I think that
he's going up.
And if that happened, I think that elements of the U.S. government would, I think, see a preference to Assad to a vacuum in Syria and another safe haven, a possible safe haven in the Middle East. No one, of course, will say that publicly. But as Jack said, it's a difficult choice that the world faces. And the Obama administration is clearly trying to slow roll this whole diplomatic process. What Jack mentioned, the Geneva conference, whenever it happens, wherever it happens, the U.S. would like it to happen later rather than sooner to get the pendulum swinging back in the direction of the rebels.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. U.S. arms to Syria now, surveillance and Edward Snowden, genes and the high court, immigration, Colorado burning. Mark Mazzetti is with us from the New York Times, national security correspondent there. Chief congressional reporter for USA Today, Susan Davis, is with us from Washington. And Jack Beatty is here. We want to get to the surveillance and the NSA, but we've got calls on Syria. Let me bring in Tom from Des Moines, Iowa. Tom, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, good day.
Hi.
We're in a very difficult position because we haven't acted to back up our statements about the necessity of Assad leaving. That was a good first step, but now we've, having not done anything for two and a half years or so, we have to back it up.
What would you do?
Well, and what we have to do is, as the president is now saying, we have to supply arms to the rebels, and that is a sort of a paradoxical way of having moral clarity here, because to facilitate war is not the optimal position.
What would you provide, Tom? What kind of weaponry?
I would provide anti-aircraft weapons to the opposition and let them do their own no-fly zone. The flights that the Assad regime is using to attack the rebels has increased, as the New York Times has reported, and the rebels keep saying, just get these Syrian government planes out of the air, and we will win this war.
Tom, let us pick it up right there. Mark Mazzetti, what about it? I think you guys reported 500 Assad government flights in the last month or so. That's a lot. No wonder the rebels are in trouble. What about anti-aircraft to the rebels and let them bring down Assad's air force?
Well, you're right. The U.S. intelligence estimates are that there's been over 500 air sorties over the last happened last month in May. And Assad this month is obviously stepping up his air campaign. The concern, of course, with anti-aircraft weapons is that what happens to those weapons when the fighting stops? So-called man pads, which are shoulder-fired rockets. We all know that they were can be very effective. They were effective against the Soviets in Afghanistan. The concern is that Islamists getting those weapons could eventually take down commercial aircraft, airliners. That introducing those into the theater could only have implications regionally against American allies. So that is the administration is still drawing the line on anti-aircraft, and I don't see it happening anytime soon.
Boy, after all this blood spilled, what a situation to be in. Bob in Bloomington, Indiana. Bob, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just don't see why we have to go in Syria. I mean, I know it sounds heartless, but if Assad puts down the revolution, then there is going to be some stability. And what your guest just said about Afghanistan is a really good point. I mean, if we have a replay of Afghanistan like in the 1980s, aren't we just going to end up with another 9/11 20-some years later? I mean, aren't we just going to breed the hatred if we do it and we kind of do it half-assed?
We got it, Bob. I mean, Jack, how about, is this the new American calculus? After all the big talk, stability, whatever it takes, even if it's Assad, the regime we condemned as murderous.
Well, you know, I thought there was a hint of that. I wonder what Mark thinks about that in a John Kerry quote the other day. He said basically, look, the rebels don't have to win. That was one of his criteria for success here. They don't have to win. We want the killing to stop, and we want Syria to remain one, integral. Mm-hmm. You know, now
raising explicitly the fear that it could break up and bring what chaos with it.
That's right. That's right. And maybe carrying the implicit suggestion that, you know, if Assad is able to restore order, if Syria is able to remain one, if the killing does go down, the administration, I'm sure, would be just as happy.
Susan, let me bring it to you. When John McCain says, when Lindsey Graham says, get in there, is it on humanitarian grounds or strategic grounds? You hear our caller in Bloomington, Indiana, saying strategically, he's not sure stability wouldn't be the best thing. Susan, are you there? Well, I'll take it to you, Mark, if you're there. Mark Mazzetti, what do you think? Jack, sorry, we're having studio trouble right there. I don't know. Let me take it to Linda in Columbia, South Carolina. Linda, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, I was just, my comment is that, you know, everyone's talking about, well, we should have done this before, we should have done that before. And first of all, we weren't even out of two other wars. We weren't out of Iraq. We weren't out of Afghanistan.
Yep.
And, you know, to this point, we haven't known who's the rebels, which rebels are we going to arm. You have other groups involved in Syria. And it's a very, very tricky situation because we don't know, us getting involved, is that going to mire us again into another war and explode into a regional war?
Let us pick it up, Linda. Jack, I think we're trying to get Susan and Mark back on the air here, but there's a question. Now, the Al-Qaeda-leaning rebels have only grown in strength and presence in the time that the U.S. has not gone in. Was it a mistake not to go in earlier, Jack, on humanitarian grounds, on political grounds? I mean, you know the Assad regime's record. Do you not have sympathy with the rebels who tried to push it out?
Oh, of course, of course. And, you know, in hindsight, you'd say if we had, you know, when it looked like a sort of liberal or, you know, Arab Spring protest against him in the name of humanity and human rights, stop the killing of children. Yes, if we had intervened then, perhaps it all would have worked. But we don't know. And the other thing is, look at the context. It was just not on the political cards that in an election year or the run-up to an election year that the president would ever do anything like that. As it was, Libya, which was a sort of one-off, you know, quick campaign out and so on, even that was very controversial with the public, and there's no evidence that it helped him at all politically, may have hurt him. So I just don't think politically it was possible. And then there's the other question. I mean, is the United States around, is our role in the world to just sort of intervene in other people's conflicts because our humanitarian feelings are actuated, or is it our necessity, or should we only just reserve that for moments when our vital security interests are at stake?
Susan Davis, I think we got you back. Let me come to you with the same question about the support for intervention on Capitol Hill. If you look at John McCain or Lindsey Graham, are they saying go in on humanitarian grounds or on strategic grounds? I don't know if you heard our caller saying strategically the stability of Assad staying in power might be the best thing for the U.S. What's the McCain argument for going in?
Well, they've made both the humanitarian and forcefully the national security element. Part of what Lindsey Graham has said is we are now dealing with a regime that has these chemical weapons, which is in a fairly unstable environment, and he is worried that the threat of the spread of these weapons could eventually get into the wrong hands and sort of that strain of thought. What I do think some of the pushback or some of the questions I think we're going to hear as this debate goes forward in the immediate future, and particularly from people on Capitol Hill, is there's not a very clear line of who the good guys are in this situation, in the sense that if they are ultimately successful and Assad goes, who is going to lead Syria and who are the rebels? And is this idea that the rebels are this, benevolent force or a better ally to the U.S. is, I think, going to raise a lot of skepticism and a lot of question on Capitol Hill, that not only do we intervene, but if we prevail, what happens next? And that is a question that I'm not sure anyone in the administration or in Congress can provide a very reassuring, clear answer to.
Mark, we've got to get to the NSA. But on that front, the Islamist presence has only grown during this time the U.S. has not intervened. I mean, where's the cynicism going to be about all the American protests of support for the rebels if their support is only kind of putative and late and partial?
Right. I mean, we'll have to see when the support shows up, when the arms show up, whether it does turn any tide or change the dynamic at all. I mean, your caller is right. I mean, not to be flip, but it is sort of War of the Worlds going on right now there. You have the Islamists having a growing presence. You have Hezbollah and Iran coming in on the other side to support the Assad regime. And you have moderate forces that, you know, the United States will now support, and Gulf states have been trying to support, certain Gulf states. So there are serious questions about whether to get involved. And Jack brought up Libya. I mean, there's part of the caution here on Syria is because Libya certainly hasn't turned out to be the stable democratic country, at least yet, that many hoped. I mean, Libya is a mess right now after Gaddafi, and arms flowed into Libya, and now it's really degenerating into militias. And Syria is a far more strategically important country and a far more strategically important part of the Middle East. And so that's it makes it exponentially more difficult.
Well, let's turn to the NSA. It's a big story in itself. There's going to be a lot more on Syria as these arms, I guess, begin to flow. What a picture there on timing and where U.S. interests will ultimately be judged to lie. I want to roll the tape back to last weekend when we first started hearing from the NSA leaker, Edward Snowden, high school dropout, 29 years old, former systems contractor for the CIA. And suddenly, via The Guardian and more, we were hearing about his view of American security and all kinds of information laid out on the table about what the NSA was doing. Snowden said it was a problem for American liberty.
Even if you're not doing anything wrong, you're being watched and recorded. And the storage capability of these systems increases every year consistently by orders of magnitude, to where it's getting to the point you don't have to have done anything wrong. You simply have to eventually fall under suspicion from somebody, even by a wrong call.
Edward Snowden saying, watch out, America, there's a big bad system at work right around you. Yesterday, as FBI Director Robert Mueller testified before the House, Democratic Michigan Congressman John Conyers said he worried that these programs may go too far.
It's my fear that we are on the verge of becoming a surveillance state.
But the president says, look, everybody's paying attention. You've got to have some trust in your government. Here's President Obama on Wednesday.
If people can't trust not only the executive branch, but also don't trust Congress and don't trust federal judges to make sure that we're abiding by the Constitution, due process, and rule of law, then we're going to have some problems here.
Susan Davis, you've been watching on Capitol Hill as people dug into this in the course of the week. A lot of outrage expressed over these leaks on American surveillance techniques. Also, though, concern about liberty. Where's the balance of attention to this stand at the end of the week, Susan?
Well, the thing that I think is interesting about what Mr. Conyers just said is, I'm not sure. I think there's less of a question that we're on the verge of a surveillance state and the fact that we're in a surveillance state. The thing that I would say broadly for the reaction from Congress has been wholly supportive of these programs. There are certainly voices of protest on Capitol Hill. I think two of the most prominent ones we're going to hear more from are Senators Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, who are two Democrats who have as close as you can publicly question these programs have done so. And part of the difficult part for senators and lawmakers who have problems with these programs is there's very little they can actually say publicly, and that Ron Wyden has been very candid about this, is that in many ways his hands are tied in being as candid as he would like to have because so much of this information is classified. I do think that there's also a little bit of a divide, although on the whole, and I would say of the lawmakers of jurisdiction on intelligence and other committees, there is a very broadly held view that Edward Snowden is a criminal and should be prosecuted as that. Not all lawmakers are convinced of that. Some lawmakers have said they're not sure of what he did was treason, or and they need to see a more clear criminal statute against him. In response to it, I do not get the sense that these programs are going to be fundamentally altered or undermined going forward. What I do think the conversation is about now is less about the programs themselves and more a debate over how much we should know about them. There is pending legislation to ask the FISA courts to just be more candid and disclose more about why they decide to listen to the calls that they are given the warrant to go listen to. There's also a question of these security contractors. As you said, Snowden was failed out of the Army, did not have a college degree, had questionable access to this information, and the proliferation of private security contractors. And there's, I think, going to probably be a debate over whether that kind of information should be restricted to government or military personnel, or increase the qualifications for people that are allowed to have access to that kind of information.
We'll talk about what that would require in an age when so much is contracted out, and in intelligence, not least. Of course, that high dudgeon was very evident. We had Democrats talking treason here. We had John Boehner, Republican Speaker of the House, calling Snowden a traitor.
He's a traitor. The president outlined last week that these are important national security programs to help keep Americans safe and give us tools to fight the terrorist threat that we face. The disclosure of this information puts Americans at risk. It shows our adversaries what our capabilities are, and it's a giant violation of the law.
We'll see where that sentiment goes. Chester in Frankfort, Kentucky. Chester, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. Mr. Esbrook, it's good you take my call. Sir, I think Mr. Edward Snowden is a hero. I think that he's the Paul Revere of the 21st century.
Why exactly?
Well, because he's letting the American people know what the American government is doing. In my eyes, in the way I feel, that they're breaking the Constitution of the United States.
Chester, I appreciate your call. Mark Mazzetti, are you there? Do you see a Paul Revere hero in Edward Snowden, Mark?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. There's certainly going to be plenty of Americans who echo the caller's sentiment that it would take someone who comes forward, risks life in prison in order to blow the whistle in their minds on some of these programs. I think it's right now the polls show that it's fairly evenly divided in the country about whether this person was right to do what he did, or whether he broke the law, should go to jail, and was a traitor. I think as we learn more about some of the programs, maybe and as we sort of follow the Edward Snowden story and see what ultimately happens to him, some of those opinions might change. But, the caller clearly has a concern about what is going on in secret in terms of eavesdropping on Americans. And he thinks that it needs, there need to be more Edward Snowdens in the world.
I want to look at that Snowden piece. Do we know where he is? There's talk that he may go to China. Is that just smearing the guy, or could he actually defect? Is there concern or evidence that may be on the boards? Is there more leaking to come, Mark?
Well, I think that there's more information to come. He's already given a lot of information to The Guardian that has not yet been published. So we can be sure that The Guardian will continue to publish. I don't know whether he has actually any more to leak.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, one dead, scores injured in a fiery chemical plant explosion in Gismar, Louisiana. Worker Darren Broussard saw it all unfold.
All you saw was a big cloud of white smoke. And then 2 seconds after that, you saw the burst of flames. And If you wasn't hightailing out of there, you was going to get burnt.
Out of Geismar, after a major ruling from a federal judge relaxing rules on the waiting list for an adult lung transplant, 10-year-old Sarah Murnahan successfully received new lungs. Just in time, said her mother, Janet.
This is like just a blessing from God. I mean, I feel like just it came at just the last minute, and we wouldn't have made it much longer.
And on Tuesday, 11-year-old Mexican-American Sebastian de la Cruz sang the national anthem in his mariachi outfit during Game 3 of the NBA Finals in San Antonio, his hometown, then became the target of racist rants on Twitter. Last night, the Spurs brought him back for an encore. This was Sebastian Tuesday night. There was the young man. We're looking at a week in the news. U.S. arms to Syria, surveillance, and Edward Snowden, genes in the high court, immigration, Colorado burning. Susan Davis is here, chief congressional reporter for USA Today. Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for the New York Times. And our own Jack Beatty. We've got more calls on the NSA. Alex in Charleston, South Carolina. Alex, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to put forth the statement that having a whistleblower has been a storied, long tradition in this country, and that our president, and I respect our president at the utmost, facing the adversity he has, and coming up pretty well is tough to do. But when he says that we need to trust our government, that we don't trust the Congress, we don't trust the White House, the judicial branch, trust is a two-way street, and they have done nothing in past, well, let's see, 12, 16 years to justify any of that trust.
So you're glad for the whistleblower, maybe, in the face of mistrust. Appreciate your call, Alex. Susan Davis, may I ask you on this trust front? The president and others are saying, look, we've got lots of branches of government overseeing this, and we've heard members of Congress attesting that they were on top of it. But does that ring true? Did they really, is there effective oversight here, Susan? Did they really know what was going on?
Well, a couple of things. And to the trust component, I think you can probably fairly easily say that there's not a tremendous amount of trust among the public and in the government. I mean, if you just look at public opinion surveys out as recently as this week, Congress has approval late ratings of 10%. The faith in the presidency is something like 36%. I mean, there is this pervasive doubt about the government on a broad scale right now. To the oversight question, it's hard to say. I mean, this is part of the trust debate in that even the senators and the lawmakers who are briefed on this, and they are held in members-only national security briefings, for the most part, staff is almost monolithically not allowed in, and that even for lawmakers to talk about what happens in these briefings would make themselves vulnerable to the point of law. What Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, and others have noted this week, and when the president said after that was first disclosed that every member of Congress has been made aware of these programs, he misspoke in some respects. I think that every member of Congress has been provided the ability to have access to briefings in which they talk about these programs. The day that the story broke, there was an emergency Senate Intelligence Committee briefing, and out of 100 senators, 27 showed up. So there's an element of oversight where the vigorousness of it has to come from Congress. I mean, the executive branch is not going to seek out vigorous oversight of what it's doing. That, and it doesn't matter who's president. It's not the nature of the executive branch to do so. I do think when you see you can see the frustration among some lawmakers. Ron Wyden is a good example of one who has raised significant questions about this, and it does sort of span the political spectrum. People like Rand Paul, who has made civil liberties sort of a platform that he has ran on successfully, so there's going to be a lot of questions raised. What one senator, Marco Rubio, made a point that I thought was notable coming out of one of these briefings is that there is going to be a debate about this. But the debate is going to happen behind closed doors, and the changes they do or do not make to these programs will also probably be classified. So in the end, how this plays out, we still may not have full disclosure on. And again, it would be citing for national security reasons.
Mark, let me bring it to you, if I may. I'll come right to you, Jack. But on this issue of oversight, because the American public is being asked to accept that there's reasonable, strong oversight of very potent technology and surveillance here. The assertion has been from Congress, Mark, that, hey, we knew about this. Senator Chambliss, Georgia, this is nothing particularly new, he said. Do you buy that, Mark? Is there nothing new in this to the public? It certainly sounds new. Did Congress really understand what was going on before Snowden's leaks?
President Obama said he wanted to have a discussion about this, a public discussion. And the problem with a public discussion is you can't have one if everything's secret. And there's no indication that there's going to be declassification of a lot of this stuff so the public can better understand this. So therefore, you rely on Congress. And as you asked, is Congress performing effective oversight? I mean, there are a handful of people in Congress who, maybe more than a handful, who really have access to all of the details of these programs. And the more you dig into whether it's surveillance or drones, targeted killing, the more you realize that actually Congress's ability to do oversight is really limited. When we were covering the John Brennan confirmation hearing early this year to be CIA director, we learned that Congress, the Senate Intelligence Committee, didn't even have the legal memos justifying the targeted killing program. So if they don't, and they're the only ones in America who have access to this, are supposed to have access, they don't have the legal memos, well, then how are the public supposed to have a better understanding of whether this is right or wrong? So this deck is really stacked against Congress, I think, because the executive branch is so powerful. But this isn't letting Congress off the hook. I think that they haven't done an effective enough job doing rigorous oversight themselves.
Jack, Americans want to be properly protected. They also want the Constitution to be respected. The president says you've got to trust your government. Do you see grounds for doing that here, Jack?
Well, here's a little exemplum of why we shouldn't. Ron Wyden, I think this was several weeks ago, was questioning Intelligence Director Clapper, James Clapper. And he asked him, is the NSA collecting data about millions of Americans? And the answer, no, sir. Clapper said, not wittingly. So Wyden was puzzled about this. The Washington Post asked him if he wanted to, pursue that. Did Clapper lie? He said, oh, I don't want to go there. But he then said, this is Ron Wyden, you cannot have strong oversight if intelligence officials don't give you straight answers. And there it was, right in public. Instead of saying, I don't want to go there, Senator, or we can't do that, or he said, no. Which, was not truthful.
Mark, people still have a lot of questions. Let me ask you about this exchange. This was Senator Susan Collins of Maine on Wednesday in the Senate Appropriations Committee, and they had the NSA chief, General Alexander, there, and she's asking him about an assertion that Snowden made, that he could go and sort of tap into basically anybody's emails. Here's Senator Collins and General Alexander's response.
Mr. Snowden claimed that due to his position at NSA, he could tap into virtually any American's phone calls or emails. True or false?
False. I know of no way to do that.
Mark Mazzetti, do you buy the general's denial, his assertion that could not be done?
It's hard to really know, because obviously General Alexander knows far more about the capabilities of these programs than we do. It's possible Mr. Snowden did exaggerate a bit about his own powers, but we do know that because he had this access as a systems administrator, it gave him probably more access to these programs and to the capabilities of the programs than maybe a regular analyst. I think it's probably unlikely that he could have just tapped anyone's phone. And experts I've spoken to since then, he's made that claim, also question that. But it's very clear he had access to details about the programs. And the NSA is this large, incredibly powerful organization. And the more we learn about it, certainly the more it seems to confirm people's conspiracy theories that the NSA really can do whatever it wants and listen to whomever it wants.
Leaves us in this fuzzy land, despite all the assertions of proper oversight. One more call on this, and we'll turn Todd in Fort Rucker, Alabama. Todd, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to point out that, personally, I believe that Snowden did violate the law. However, looking at the reason behind it, he's pointing something out that organizations like the NSA, they have a tremendous amount of power with these systems, and there's great potential to be for misuse.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also, I mean, you know, nobody, I don't know if anybody's mentioned this, but we're talking about possible violations of the Constitution as, like, not just the Fourth Amendment, we're talking about, like, the Ninth Amendment. We're talking about rights that are not enumerated. And, you know, with new technologies that are able to mine data and predict, you know, people's everyday movements or constantly surveil people, that's a huge amount of power and ability for just one organization to have, and not for the American people not to know about it.
Yeah.
Or have some knowledge. It just doesn't make sense, because the government is supposed to be about we the people, you know.
These are almost powers they could not enumerate in the 18th century, and here we are in 2013 wrestling with them. Todd, I'm glad you put it just that way. I want to turn, we've got a few more issues to look at here and not a lot of time. I want to come to immigration, but let me preface it with this. This was Tuesday on the floor of the U.S. Senate. This was the first full speech in the United States Senate ever to be delivered entirely in Spanish. It was Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia urging Congress to support a bipartisan immigration overhaul.
Aunque no es perfecto, puedo pararme aquí hoy.
Okay, we've had phrases before in Spanish. We've had little bits here and there. But here is Senator Kaine, former governor of Virginia, who spent time living in Honduras, running a Roman Catholic school there with Jesuit missionaries when he was younger. Susan Davis, what's going on when we've got full-on Spanish on the floor of the Senate? Who's Tim Kaine speaking to?
In some ways, you could argue that Tim Kaine is speaking to his own constituents. He's from the state of Virginia, and one of the, mm-hmm. you know, where the population is growing in the state of Virginia is in the D.C. metro area, which has a significant Hispanic and Latino population. So in some ways, you could say it was good politics for him. In other ways, I think maybe he just wanted to show how good his Spanish skills were. So.
I mean, people getting racist on Twitter over a boy singing in traditional Mexican outfit. Here, the senator saying, you know, it's time. I've got the Spanish and I need to use it to communicate to my fellow Americans. Where does the immigration debate stand at the end of this week, Susan? Early in the week, it's up on the rails and people say, hey, maybe we're going. And then it seems like back in the same old crunch. Where does it stand?
You know, I say that's just par for the course in the United States Senate, if you pay attention to when they go through these debates. I do think that the debate started this week on a fairly positive tone for those who are advocating for the overhaul, because the vote to go to this debate received, I believe, 85 votes, which in the Senate is a pretty significant show of support.
Mm-hmm.
The next 3 weeks are what's going to be critical in the Senate, although I do think that the momentum seems to be there to pass a bill out of the chamber. You can feel it when you talk to senators on both sides. The two debates that I think that will dominate the chamber in June, as Mitch McConnell put it, borders and benefits. The last time we did immigration reform, the pathway to citizenship was really what tore it down. And I think that issue is still going to be very much an issue in the House. In the Senate, there seems to be more of a recognition that the pathway is going to be in there. The two issues that are going to be complicated is whether and how we should trigger the pathway to citizenship by securing the U.S.-Mexico border. There's going to be a lot of tough amendments on that question. One lead one from John Cornyn, who's a Republican senator from Texas. The other one is the question of benefits. There's a lot of opposition to the idea that for the 11 million undocumented that are in the country, that while they're in this transitional period, whether they should be able to have access to federal benefits. There's also a question of when they go through this process, should they have to pay back taxes? And those are three, I think, of the issues that need to be resolved before they can get to final passage. And if they fall apart, it could see the bill collapse on its own weight.
We'll hear
it's
more
important.
On that. Sorry, Tom.
Well,
while we have time, I want to touch one more issue, if I may, and try to get the Colorado fires. But we've got this military sex assault issue and a big debate and vote there in the Senate Armed Services Committee voting against this week a bill that would have taken military chain of command out of the process of reviewing sexual assault cases. The bill's sponsor, here we've got tape of New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, urging her colleagues not to forget the victims.
We can believe them or we cannot believe them. Many here don't believe the victims. They don't believe the victims. They don't believe chain of command's the problem. I urge people to support our original version of the personnel markup.
They didn't do it. What's going to happen here, Susan? Is the chain of command going to be broken or not, ultimately?
Probably not, ultimately. I do think when the bill gets to the full Senate later this year, Senator Gillibrand has said that she will offer it again to have a vote among the full Senate. This was just in committee. It's important to note that the committee did pass some language that was supported by Chairman Levin and Senator Claire McCaskill that would require any sexual assault that is dismissed by a commander to be reviewed by a secretary of the branch that they serve in. So they did tighten up sort of the way the system works now, but it did not go as far reaching as the Gillibrand Amendment. What was interesting about that amendment is it did spring up a broad spectrum of support. She did receive the support from senators like Ted Cruz, who's a very well-known Tea Party senator. So it's possible when it comes up for a full vote that we could see this debate reinvigorated in the fall.
Jack, we've got people calling in asking about the fires in Colorado, the scale of them unbelievable, and so early in the year, thousands and thousands evacuating, hundreds and hundreds of homes wiped out, and we're not into July, we're not into August, we're not into the really driest time of the year. I mean, people just fixated on weather and fires and trouble in our environment lately, Jack, and wondering what's going on.
Yeah, and you made a good point, Tom, this morning, which is that the media, the networks are playing to this subterranean fear, sense of apocalypse by making so much of these weather stories. You know, I turned on the news last night expecting to get Syria first thing. I did not. I got fires in Colorado.
But maybe that's justified when you've got hundreds of homes going up in flames. That's a big deal. People look at the environment and wonder, where are we headed here? It's hard to fault them for fearing the apocalyptic.
When Colorado seems to be burning, it certainly does.
Well, we will keep an eye on all this in the week ahead. We're grateful to all of you for being with us today. Susan Davis with USA Today, chief congressional reporter there. Thank you so much for joining us, Susan.
Thanks, Tom.
Mark Mazzetti, good luck with your reporting on the NSA, Syria, and much more. Thanks for being with us today from the New York Times, Mark.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
And Jack, always good to have you right here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You can join us anytime online at onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gelrosen, Eileen Amata, Emily Alphen-Johnson, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.